My dear Mama, for 3 months we've been in the battle. Heavens, what is it all for? The greatness of the fatherland? The glory of the Kaiser? Or some motive of that kind? If so, it is after all a small thing. And neither united Germany nor our respected Kaiser had need all of this bloodshed. I cannot tell you, my dearly beloved mother, what pictures of hell pass ceaselessly before my eyes. I seem to be living in a red dream and among flames. Of what use to me will have been my long studies and my hopes to make you happy in your old age? To die miserably for a mysterious cause. Thousands of us all are in this case. Good and faithful comrades of mine who, like me, asked only to be allowed to live in joy and work. I have seen fall in the hail of lead and iron, or perish of cold and almost of hunger. It is no longer possible to win this war. We've been dragged into it by lying. The Allied enemies were better prepared than us for winning, and every day lessens our strength. I cannot send you this letter by the ordinary way, for it tells the truth, and I should be severely punished if it were read by our chiefs. It will be sent to you, I hope, by him who picked me up dead on the soil of France, which I would never have set foot on. My last thought will be for you. Goodbye till eternity, my sweet, darling mother. Otto Cohenstein. And what young Otto predicted there, his own death in the soil of France, a country that he says he had no wish to visit, it came true. Not long afterwards, he was killed, fighting against the French, and that letter was found on his body, not by one of his own German comrades, but by an enemy soldier. We don't know anything about young Otto. I can't find him on the internet. I don't know how to look for German casualties in the Great War. But what we do know was that he died on the Champagne battlefields in the first few months of the war, and that he was from southern Germany, from the area of Bavaria. And it was published in several newspapers back home in England, and no doubt in France as well. And the particular headline that I'm looking at above the letter, above the article, it says, "Pictures of Hell, Germany Dragged into War by Lying," and was no doubt used at the time for propaganda. But what an insight into the mind of that young man we get from those few words to his mum. And how many more letters like that were sent home during the course of over 4 years of trench warfare on the Western Front and beyond, and also in other wars. Here we sit in the 21st century with problems all around us, of course, our own personal problems, problems further afield. But we cannot possibly put ourselves into the position of young Otto or the millions of others that are in the same position. But this week we're going to try and do exactly that, because I've found several accounts of soldiers that wrote about their feelings and experiences. That's not unusual in itself, but what's different about these accounts is, like Otto, all of the writers of the words that I'm going to read to you over the next hour or so were not necessarily their final words, but they weren't to write any more letters or articles, because they also, like Otto, perished on the Western Front during World War I. Tragically, none of the lads that we're going to talk about today were to see their homeland again, were to see their loving mum again, or their children, or their wives, or their own house. None of them. They're all still somewhere on the Western Front. So stick with me as we delve into the minds of those men that through this podcast, through our visits to the battlefields, we're hoping will never, ever be forgotten. Whilst Otto was fighting the French, further north there was a young man called Daniel Glassman, and he was serving with the 1st Battalion, the Duke of Cornwall Light Infantry. And he lived in my hometown in Northampton. And in December 1914, just before that first Christmas, he'd been at the front for a month, and he wrote a letter home that gives us an idea of what he was experiencing. And we can see that it's very similar to what Otto was experiencing hundreds of miles south and on the other side of the wire. Daniel said, "It's simply awful out here. We are making good progress and we've got the Germans properly in a fix. We are all treated well. We have plenty of cigarettes. And if it was good weather, we could be happy. Just imagine what it is to be wet through for days and no sleep or a wash. But we're all contented because we know that all is being done for us that can be done. We have received nice fur coats, but they have got wet through. I spent days in the trenches with bullets and shells whistling over my head. I had a narrow escape the first day I went in. A party of us had to relieve another party about 8 p.m. When we were about halfway, the Germans turned a Maxim machine gun on us. Of course, we all threw ourselves on the ground. The man next to me was shot through the neck and a bullet went through my pack. I found it later in my canteen." So Daniel there is, on the one hand, telling his parents that they're going through all sorts of hardships. But on the other hand, he's saying that I'm being positive because I've had a close shave, but I wasn't killed. A bullet went through my pack instead of through me. But a few months later, on the 15th of June 1915, up at Ypres, his luck ran out and he was killed in action. I've been to Daniel's grave. He was just 19 years old and he was from the Jewish religion. And on his headstone is the cap badge of his regiment. And beneath his personal details is that Star of David. When I've been guiding battlefield tours, we'd often read these accounts, and sometimes if it involves a relative, I get the relative to read the last words or some of the final words of the soldier whose footsteps we're following in. And there's something very haunting about it, of course there is, listening to the voices of the men that didn't return, sometimes looking at their headstone or the place where they died. But it's also in some way comforting to hear the words from those people. We like to think what they were thinking and how they were feeling. And from these accounts, we know exactly what they were thinking and how they were feeling. Let's continue, shall we? If you go to the Teepval Memorial and look for the Sherwood Foresters, the Nottinghamshire and Derbyshire Regiment, you'll find a Private 18260 John Dewsbury close to the base of the pier on the right hand side as you come up the steps. I think it's pier number 10 from memory. You can download a photograph of John from the internet and stand there, as I've done many, many times with groups. And what was happening for John on the 15th of September 1916, his battalion were making a successful attack near the village of Ginchy as part of the tank attack, the famous tank attack that we talked about many times before on the podcast. And they were attacking a fortified German strong point. And on that day, his unit had 38 men that were killed. 30 of them are missing, like John, and are remembered on the Teepval Memorial, and 5 are buried in the Gullimont Road Cemetery. But what's different about John? Well, two things, really. Firstly, his family were of German heritage. His family name was Dewsbury, and that was spelt D-U-E-S-B-E-R-Y. And secondly, and most importantly, we know exactly how he was feeling, because after he died, his comrades came back, they found his body, they buried him, his grave was later lost in the fighting. But on his body, they found a letter, just like Otto. First story we talked about, a letter that he'd written to his mum. As he lay there in a shell hole, he found a pencil and a piece of paper and he wrote these words to his mum. And I've read these words so many times over the years on the battlefield, at Teepval, in talks that I've given to groups. But every time I do, it still leaves a lump in my throat. But let's see how I get on this time. He says, "Dear mother, I'm writing these few lines severely wounded. We've done well. Our battalion has advanced 3/4 of a mile. I'm laid in a shell hole with 2 wounds in my hip and through my back. I cannot move or crawl at all. I've been here for 24 hours and I've never seen a living soul. I hope you receive these few lines, as I don't expect anyone will come to take me away. But you know I've done my duty out here now for 1 year and 8 months and you will always have the consolation that I died quite happy doing my duty. You must give my best to all of the cousins who have been so kind to me for the time I've been out here, and all the best of love to you, Mother, and Harry, and all at Swinefleet. And then he passed into the abyss. I wonder how his mum felt when she got that letter. I wonder what happened to her, I don't know. Someone perhaps does. But his final thoughts were for his mum, and he wanted to give her the consolation that he wasn't in any pain, and he was proud, and he was happy. He wasn't happy, was he? And he was quite resigned to his fate. I've looked at the census in 1911 to find out a little bit more information about John, and he wasn't living with his mum at that stage. A lot of people in those days lived with their grandparents, and he was, and all of the family members listed on the census, their names are spelt using the German spelling. He was 20 years old at that stage, single, and working in the gasworks as a labourer, which means he was 25 years old when he died 5 years later on the Somme. On the 13th of October 1915, the last major action of the Battle of Loos took place, and in amongst the men that died that day was a Captain Charles Hamilton Sawley. He was a captain, as I said, in the 7th Battalion of the Suffolk Regiment. And he was shot dead by a sniper. He was aged 20 years old, and his last poem was recovered from his kit. Unfortunately, he has no known grave like so many that died in that battle and is commemorated on the Loos Memorial. And Sawley is one of those that only served for a brief time on the Western Front, that he left behind this poem.
When you see millions of the mouthless dead, by Charles Hamilton Sawley. When you see millions of the mouthless dead, across your dreams in pale battalions go, say not soft things as other men have said, that you'll remember, for you need not so. Give them not praise, for deaf, how should they know? It is not curses heaped on each gashed head, nor tears, their blind eyes see not your tears flow, nor honour, it is easy to be dead. Say only this, they are dead, then add thereto, yet many a better one has died before. Then scanning all the o'ercrowded mass, should you perceive one face that you loved heretofore, it is a spook, none wears the face you knew. Great death has made all his forevermore.
It's a fallacy, of course, to say that most men died in World War One. I think the percentage of death is only about 12%. But in this case, Sawley was clearly thinking ahead, wondering about his fate and coming to terms with the thought of death. I want to look as well at as many German experiences as we can. And I have here some transcripts of some letters that were sent by a young man called Hans Spieb, and he was from Bavaria and serving with the 5th Reserve Cavalry Rifles Regiment. And he wrote several letters revealing his anxieties and his experiences, and also the hopes that the end of the war might come as his letters went on. The first one is dated 1916. He says, "All the nice villages are piles of rubble now. In the previous positions, we were lying with our rifles in a church that was shot to pieces. Nearby was the graveyard. Then the artillery started firing right into the graveyard so that the bones were flying around and into our faces. The worst and most moving of all is when one's best comrade is getting torn apart and one is supposed to leave him next to you until it is dark. Then he can be buried. Please don't be upset now and don't forget to pray. Then we will meet again. This is not war anymore. It is just murder. And who is to blame for that?" On the 28th of December, he writes again to his parents and siblings, and he's just spent another Christmas on the Western Front. He says, "My dears, I really thought that it would have come to an end by this time, but it won't. One just has to go on and hope. It can't be long. Therefore, the dear mother should not be worried. There would not be enough paper around here to write down everything I would like to tell. Thank God I'm still well and hope the same of you. All of my love from your son and brother Hans. Farewell till we meet again. Answer soon. Shouldn't be underplayed, really, the effect that letters had on the troops at the front and the families back home. This was the one thing that worked really well. Millions of letters every week were sent backwards and forwards from the front line, and it gave the troops at the front, it gave them morale, a boost to receive letters from their loved ones, whether it be from their parents or their wives or perhaps their sweethearts. So many of them had got married just before they went to the Western Front. They wanted to know what was going on at home. And so many of the letters survive, like this one, from soldiers who wrote back home. But there's not so many of the letters that went the other way. Because one thing that was in great shortage and probably didn't exist at all on the Western Front was toilet roll. So that the soldiers would read those letters over and over again, cherish the photos that had been sent to them, perhaps of a newborn baby that they hadn't yet met. But once they'd done that and digested all the information, they went to latrines and those letters served another purpose. 8 months later, in August 1917, of course, the war is still going on and he's still there. He writes to his mum again. There must be an end at some time. Even a 30 years war was over once. In July 1918, he's transferred to the 2nd Bavarian Infantry Division. And by this time, he's showing the signs of fatigue from the front line. He says, our division alone lost 3,400 men and 1,100 horses during these attacks, which also caused a lot of damage over and above. The aeroplanes destroyed our baggage train. We had to survive on horse meat and with the help of what we took from the dead men. Just try to imagine this. We built up cover for our rifles with the corpses. You could smell the odour of it. Nobody can be buried. There are corpses lying around who were killed 4 weeks ago. And then the heat, it is enough to drive one to utter despair. There is no quietness behind the lines in the rear any longer. The following month saw the start of the British offensive in August 1918, the start of the end of the war, I suppose, the final 100-day offensive. And he's promoted to NCO, and he writes to his parents and siblings on the 16th of August. So this is, what, 8 days, just a week or so after that 100-day offensive has begun. He says, otherwise I'm still healthy and hope the same is true of you. It doesn't look too good any longer with the war. Quite a lot of us have been taken prisoner of war, about 80,000 men. The same amount of men are said to have laid down their arms. All my love from your hands. And as the Germans retreat and lose all those casualties, their replacements are not the fine soldiers that the German army had boasted up to now. And Hans reflects that in another letter to his parents and siblings on the 27th of August. He says, we're lying right in the open field. I don't have to work and be on guard anymore, but I have to be there all the time. The further reserves we are getting are just children. They cry and scream for their mother when they have to go out into the fire. 2 months later, the 10th of October, we're now just a month from the end of the war, although of course Hans wouldn't know that. But he knows it's coming. He says the war can't last much longer. We're always moving backwards. We are busy holding up the enemy troops. They are attacking us every day. You can imagine how many of our men does that cost. 11 days later, he writes again. I am presently still alive. I can't tell you what is happening here on the German side. There is no quiet moment anymore. We had to move back more than 100 kilometres within a few days. Whoever can't run is taken prisoner. Please don't be upset. There's nothing we can do. There are no men left. It won't take long this way. All my love, your Hans. So he knows that the war is coming to an end. And in fact, it's just, what, 3 weeks away at this stage. He's hoping perhaps he's going to be taken prisoner or the war will come to an end. But that was to be his last letter home. That was the last contact that his parents and siblings or anybody else had with him. Because the very next day, Hans was killed in action when he was shot through the heart. And that was the end of his story. Now, I don't know because I wasn't there, but I would have thought on both sides of No Man's Land, the soldiers from all nations were thinking something like this. There was a French captain called Augustin Cochin, and he wrote to his mother on the 7th of July from the southern part of the Somme battlefield where the French were advancing, and he describes his contempt, really, for the enemy that he was fighting against. He says, "I'm in the middle of the spoils of the Boche and could send you a variety of things, but it will be necessary to delve into shelters full of corpses, and I do not have the courage. I collect only postcards, which all talk about the great German youth. There is nothing so flat as these letters. Anyway, they are an awful race. The more closely we see them, the more we abhor them. Bands of prisoners are despicable to see. Down, anxious to get well ahead, delighted to be taken. More were taken yesterday, with their short jackets carrying a small bundle of supplies for the trip. It's annoying to get killed from men behind the parapets by such animals. They have a special smell, very strong, which we cannot get rid of. Physically, I'm well, and morale is good also, but the intellectual side of life does not exist." And those last few words are relevant because he was a writer and historian before the First World War and very well known in France. But the following day, he died just as he said he didn't want to. They went into attack at 9 o'clock in the morning, captured several German trenches which had been smashed by the French artillery, and taken the village of Hardicourt. Cochin was in the first wave. He was directing one of his men. A German soldier took aim from a trench behind a barricade of sandbags, and at 10 past 10 a.m. he was shot in the mouth. The bullet had come out through his neck and blood was flowing freely. Cochin said to a medical orderly that tried to help him, he said, "He's not missed me. Take my equipment from me. Take me away." He's still worried about attacking. He's still worried about his men. He says, "Forward," and he indicates with his hand for the advance to continue. "My poor 9th Company, always forward, always on towards the glorious victory." The medical orderly tries to dress the wounds, but the captain, Augustin, he feels smothered by the dressing, and twice he pulls them away. And his last words were, "Embrace for me my poor father, my poor mother, my brother, the whole family." But he couldn't talk anymore. Those were his last words. And his death not only had a big impact on his family back home, but was felt throughout the French nation. As I said, he was very well known. Staying on the Somme, we've got another account here from a German soldier, a man called Eduard Offenbacher, who was a 21-year-old student from a place called Mannheim in Germany. And he said, and this is on the 14th of July, so 2 weeks into the Somme battle, "The battle is still raging violently on all fronts. The enemy is still trying to gain a decisive advantage and emblazon victory on his colours. The heroic endurance of our troops deprives him of this hope and defies even the horrible weapons of present-day warfare. And in a few days, perhaps weeks, the war will sink back into the old indefinite state of waiting while both sides prepare for further efforts and more gigantic losses and devise yet more ghastly means of destruction for another struggle, which will again prove useless and result only in a further loss of hundreds of thousands of young lives." And so it will go on until, and one is right in the middle of it all. Have the German commanders made up their minds to gain some particular point, which they will not give up, and for the sake of which they think it is worthwhile to sacrifice the wishes and well-being of the whole nation, and on which the enemy will not yield, having still too much faith in its own strength? And every single word, every single line of that writing from young Eduard was true. And just a week later, he was one of those hundreds of thousands that he talked about, hundreds of thousands of young lives. Remember, he was just 21. He was to lose his life. He was killed in action. Not far away, fighting the French, there was another German called Friedrich Steinbrecher. He was an officer, and he'd previously been a student of theology in Leipzig. And he wrote this about what was happening on the Somme. He said, "The whole history of the world cannot contain a more ghastly word than the Somme. At the beginning of the month, we left our old position. During the lorry and train journey, we were still quite cheery. We knew what we were wanted for. Then came bivouacs, an alarm, and we were rushed up through shell-shattered villages and barrage into the turmoil of war. The enemy was firing with 12-inch guns. There was a perfect torrent of shells. The last days had been stiflingly hot. Sooner than we expected, we were in the thick of it. First in the artillery position, columns were tearing hither and thither as if possessed. The gunners could no longer see or hear. Very lights were going up along the whole front, and there was a deafening noise, the cries of wounded, orders and reports. At noon, the gunfire became even more intense. And then came the order. The French had broken through. Counterattack. We advanced through the shattered wood in a hail of shells. I don't know how I found the right way. Then across an expanse of shell craters, on and on, falling down and getting up again. Machine guns were firing. I had to cut across our own barrage and the enemy's. I'm untouched. At last we reached the front line. Frenchmen are forcing their way in. The tide of battle ebbs and flows. Then things get quieter. We've not fallen back a foot. Now one's eyes begin to see things. I want to keep on running. To stand still and look is horrible. There's a wall of dead and wounded. How often I have read that phrase. Now I know what it means. Day melts into night. We're always on the alert. We can't establish communication with the rear without casualties. The wounded are in a makeshift dugout. One has to sit by without being able to do anything for them. Deserters come in. French wounded crawl into the trench with shining faces. In a moment, I got to know dozens of them. I had men belonging to three different regiments. I felt, then, what it is to be in command. It means responsibility over life and death. The men cling to one like children. I have witnessed scenes of heroism and of weakness. Men who can endure every privation. Being brave is not only a matter of will, it also requires strong nerves, though the will can do a great deal. I wish it had all been a dream, a bad dream. And yet, it was a joy to see such heroes stand and fall. The bloody work cost us 177 men. Now, he was to survive those horrors of the Somme, but less than a year later, he was killed in action in April 1917. There was all sorts of emotions in his words there, weren't there? But whatever emotions he felt, eventually the horror of the Western Front was to consume him, like all of the men that we're talking about this week. So we're going to stay on the Somme for this next story, but we're going to turn to an Australian soldier, Lieutenant Alec Rawls from the 23rd Battalion of the Australian Imperial Force. And we're going to go to Poitiers. As we know from a previous podcast, the attack on Poitiers village began on the 23rd of July 1916, and 8 days later, Alec was with a working party, and they had to dig a new jumping-off trench in no man's land that was to be used for the next phase of the attack. And in this passage, we learn how this young officer has got to control not just the men around him, but also himself. And in this letter home, he's so honest with his feelings. Doesn't try and hide how he feels. He says, we were being shot at all of the time. It was awful. We had to drive the men by every possible means and dig ourselves. The wounded and killed had to be thrown on one side. I refused to let any sound man help a wounded man. The sound man had to dig. I took it on myself to insist on the men staying, saying that any man who stopped digging would be shot. We dug on and finished amid a tornado of bursting shells. All the time, mind, the enemy flares were making the area almost as light as day. We got away as best we could. I was buried twice and thrown down several times, buried with dead and dying. So the spoil from a shell was, in this case, blown up the earth. And it's blown up men that had probably been killed the week before. And he's buried beneath that pile of earth and dead men. He says the ground was covered with bodies in all stages of decay and mutilation. And I would, after struggling free from the earth, pick up a body by me and try and lift him out with me and find a decayed corpse. I pulled a head off. It was covered with blood. The horror was indescribable. In the dim, misty light of dawn, I collected about 50 men and sent them off, mad with terror, on the right track for home. Then two brave fellows strayed behind and helped me with the only unburied wounded man we could find. The journey down with him was awful. He was delirious. I tied one of his legs to his pack with one of my putties. The sights I saw and the smell can, I know, never be exceeded by anything else the war may show me. I've had much luck and kept my nerve so far. The awful difficulty is to keep it. The bravest of all often lose it. Courage does not count here. It is nerve. Once that goes, one becomes a gibbering maniac. I don't think I've ever read an account as graphic as that, where a man is being so honest about the fear, not just of being shot and mutilated, but of losing his own nerve. And he writes so well because in professional life, he was a journalist with the Melbourne Argos. But just 3 weeks later, he was hit by a shell himself and he was killed. His comrades buried him somewhere on the battlefield between Poisier and Moquet Farm. But because of the fighting that continued to rage on the Somme in the summer of 1916, his grave was lost and he's now remembered, like so many others, on the memorial to the missing at Villers-Bretonneux. I think it's time for another poem now, and this one is written by a man called Arthur Graham West, who'd been born in Norwich in eastern England but grew up in London. He enlisted at the beginning of the war in 1914. He was originally turned down because of his poor eyesight, but eventually he managed to get into the army. But there his problems really started when he saw the reality of the horrors on the Western Front. He didn't have much time for the senior army staff, and he gradually lost his belief in the war, and he also lost his belief in religion, which was a real shame because his father was an evangelicist and a former missionary. But Arthur is most remembered probably from this anti-war poem that he wrote, and he called it God, How I Hate You.
God, how I hate you, you young, cheerful men, whose pious poetry blossoms on your graves as soon as you are in them. Hark how one chants. Oh, happy to have lived these epic days. These epic days. And he'd been to France and seen the trenches, glimpsed the huddled dead in the periscope, hung on the rusty wire, choked by their sickly foetor day and night blown down his throat, stumbled through ruined hearths, proved all that muddy brown monotony where blood's the only coloured thing. Perhaps had seen a man killed, a sentry shot at night, hunched as he fell, his feet on the firing step, his neck against the back slope of the trench, and the rest doubled between. His head smashed like an eggshell, and the warm grey brain spattered all bloody on the parados. Yet still God's in his heaven, all is right, in this best possible of worlds. God loves us. God looks down on this our strife and smiles in pity, blows a pipe at times and calls some warriors home. How rare life is. On earth, the love and fellowship of men, men sternly banded, banded for what end? Banded to maim and kill their fellow men, for even Huns are men. In heaven above, a genial umpire, a good judge of sport, won't let us hurt each other. Let's rejoice, God keeps us faithful, pens us still in fold. And what a faith is ours! Almost it seems large as a mustard seed. We trust and trust, nothing can shake us. Ah, how good God is to suffer us be born just now, when youth, that else would rust can slake his blade in gore, where very God himself does seem to walk the bloody fields of Flanders he so loves.
You can almost feel and taste the bitterness and anger towards the war, towards religion, in Arthur's voice. You can understand why men lost faith in both during those terrible experiences on the Western Front and beyond. But on the other hand, so many people clung on to their belief. You'd cling on to anything, wouldn't you, in those circumstances? Well, what was to become of Arthur? Well, he was writing there about the horrors of 1916 Somme battlefield. And as the Germans withdrew to the Hindenburg line in the spring, a few months later, the spring of 1917, the British moved forward to the town of Bapaume, and near the town, West, who by now was serving as a captain, was killed by a sniper. He's one of those that does have a grave, though. He was 25 years old, and he's buried in the HAC cemetery at Acoust, St. Maine. Captain Charles May was serving with the 22nd Battalion of the Manchester Regiment, and they were to go into attack towards the German-held village of Mametz on the first day of the Battle of the Somme, the 1st of July 1916. And Charles is another one of those men that was a journalist before the war. He'd been born in New Zealand, and he wrote some wonderfully eloquent letters home to his wife that somehow many of them escaped the censor. And he gives us an idea of what these men were feeling before they went into that big push, which, of course, as we know, they thought was going to end the war. 17th of June, so what, 2 weeks before the first day on the Somme, he wrote this to his wife: "I must not allow myself to dwell on the personal. There is no room for it here. Also, it's demoralising, but I do not want to die. Not on a mind for myself. If it be that I am to go, I am ready. But the thought that I may never see you or our darling baby again turns my bowels to water. I cannot think of it even with the semblance of equanimity. My one consolation is the happiness that has been ours. Also, my conscience is clear that I've always tried to make life a joy for you. I know at least that if I go, you will not want. That is something. But it is the thought that we may be cut off from each other which is so terrible, and that our babe may grow up without my knowing her and without her knowing me. It is difficult to face, and I know your life without me would be a dull blank. Yet you must never let it become wholly so, for to you will be left the greatest charge in all the world, the upbringing of our baby. God bless that child. She is the hope of life to me. It may well be that you only have to read these lines as one of passing interest. On the other hand, they may well be my last message to you. If they are, know through all of your life that I loved you and the baby with all my heart and soul, and that you two sweet things were just all the world to me. I pray God that I may do my duty, for I know, whatever that may entail, you would not have it otherwise." It wasn't to be his last message, because over the next 2 weeks he wrote almost daily back to Bessie. And his last diary entry is timed at 5:45 a.m. on the 1st of July, less than 2 hours before zero hour. And he said in his diary, "We marched up to the assembly trench at 9:30 last night. The most exciting march imaginable. Guns all around us crashed and roared till sometimes it was quite impossible to hear oneself speak. It was, however, a fine sight, and one realised from it what gunpowder really means. Fritz, of course, strafed back in reply, causing us some uneasiness and a few casualties before we even reached the line. The night passed noisily and with a few more casualties. The Hun puts a barrage on us every now and then and generally claims one or two victims. It's a glorious morning, and it's now broad daylight. We go over in 2 hours' time. It seems a long time to wait, and I think, whatever happens, we shall all feel relieved once the line is reached. No man's land is a tangled desert. Unless one could see it, one cannot imagine what a terrible state of disorder it is in. Our gunnery has wrecked that, and his frontline trenches all right, but we do not seem to have stopped his machine guns. They are popping off all along our parapet as I write. I trust they will not claim too many of our lads before the day is over. Now I close this old diary down for the next few days, since I may not take it into the line. I will, however, keep a record of how things go and enter it up later. The diary of the Battle of Mametz should be interesting reading. And at that point, the pocket diary is notebook number 7. It ends abruptly. A few days before that last diary entry, Charlie had written home again, and he thanked his wife for sending two roses. And he wore one of those roses when he went over the top at 7:30 that morning. His last letter, he said, "All the love and devotion of my heart and soul to you, my dear wife, and to our darling baby. Know that I will think of you all the time. Au revoir, my love." On the 30th of June, the day before the attack, his wife wrote to Charles May, and she called him Charlie. And she talks about trusting him and knowing that his company will do their best with as few casualties as possible. And she told him how happy that they'd been in their marriage. "My darling, darling boy, God be with you. I can only pray and shall only wait with what patience I can. Send me a field postcard if you have not time for more. My own, my love." But he never received that letter. He never read that letter. At 7:15 a.m. on his part of the line opposite Mametz, gas was released. At 7:22 the Stokes mortars opened up, and at 7:26 smoke canisters were discharged. And the idea of that was it would obscure to the Germans the sight of the men moving across no man's land. With 3 minutes to go, some mines buried underneath the German trenches were detonated, and Charlie would have seen those go up. At 7:30, the artillery barrage lifted, and the first wave of officers, including Charlie, blew their whistles, and they led their men up the scaling ladders, over the top and into no man's land. Now, Charlie, being an officer, had a batman with him. His name was Private Arthur Bunting, and he followed close behind him as they made their way forward, struggling across no man's land, trying to avoid the rifle and machine gun fire. Within 10 minutes, just as they reached the German lines, at a place called Bucket Trench, Charlie was hit by shell fire. Afterwards, Bunting wrote, "I was with all the other boys in the German trenches, but when the captain got hit, he'd just given me a message to pass down the lines, and I wasn't 3 yards from him. Only I had just turned the corner of the trench when I heard the shell burst and the captain called to me. I nursed him as best I could. I tied his limbs together with my putties, poor fellow. And while I was with him, I said my prayers over and over again, for it looked 1,000 to 1 on us being blown to pieces and no cover to get under. It was just a case of awaiting your turn." He remained with the body of Charlie, who'd already died, for 3 hours. He tried to look after him. He bandaged his legs together and he dragged him back to the British trenches. And there, after the day had ended, Bunting gathered together Charlie's possessions, including his wedding ring, his opened post and his unopened correspondence, and the pocketbooks, which tell us exactly what he was experiencing. He saved those and sent them back to his wife at their home in Essex. Bunting then went into correspondence with Charlie's widow, and of course she wanted to know what had happened to him. He says, "During those 3 hours that you sat by my husband, did he suffer? Was he conscious? Where were his wounds? Did he say any words at all that you could distinguish? Tell me everything. My heart aches to know." Now, this is the southern part of the Somme battlefield, and people will no doubt remember that in this part of the Somme offensive on the 1st of July, they managed to achieve their objectives, and that's just what happened here. Charlie perhaps didn't get there, but they managed to take the big German trench, which ran along the top of the ridge known as Danzig Alley, and that ran effectively from Mametz all the way to Montauban. On that day, the 22nd Manchesters had suffered 10 officers, including Charlie, and 120 other ranks killed, 8 officers and 241 men wounded, and there was another 111 missing. They were in that first wave, which is why they suffered so many casualties whilst achieving their objectives. And after the war, the Imperial War Graves Commission, as it was then, they established one of their concentration cemeteries on the location of that trench, Danzig Alley. And that's where Charlie's buried today, alongside so many others. And every time we go to his grave with Terry's tours, I read that letter that he wrote home to his wife and daughter, whilst we look at a photograph of the family, Charlie and his wife, with the young girl, perhaps a year old maybe, in between them. A lovely, happy family photo, a family that he never saw grow up. I wonder how many more children they would have had. Now, May was not stupid. He realised being an officer in the first wave, the chances of him getting through unscathed were perhaps remote. And he had a friend serving with him, a Captain F.J. Earls. And he said to him if anything was to become of him, would he look after his wife and daughter? And that's exactly what Earls did. He kept that promise because in 1919, after the war had ended, he married Charlie's widow. Now, if you're over on the Somme on an independent tour at any stage, because I don't think the organised tours go to... I've never seen any organised tour coaches in Danzig Alley Cemetery, but it's not far from Lochmagar Crater, maybe a 5-10 minute drive, just to the east of Mametz village itself. And not only is it a beautiful place to visit, you get tremendous views of the battlefield all around you. You look forward to the cemetery and you can see the village of Carnoy, where Charlie and his mates started off from that day. You can therefore see no man's land up the hill. You can see, get an idea of the topography and the positions that the Germans held that day, which didn't do them any good because the British managed to smash through those defences. And then if you go to the back of the cemetery, you can then see the horseshoe of woods in every direction, and in particular, the massive Mametz wood, which before much longer we're going to do a full podcast about. So it's an incredible place to go and see. You can see, as I said, so much of the southern part of the battlefield. And within the cemetery itself, it was made up of several smaller cemeteries that had been established after the 1st of July. And after the war, most of these were closed down, including one in Mametz itself, and moved to Danzig Alley. And there's now 2,053 burials and commemorations of the First World War, and 518 of those are unidentified, which means that about 1,500 of them do have a name, including Charlie. And there are so many others, so many interesting stories to find in Danzig Alley. And I think we're going to have to do a whole podcast on that cemetery, because, as I say, it's one of those that doesn't get visited often. It is beautiful, great views from there, and the stories behind the headstones are absolutely incredible. And some of the epitaphs, some of the family inscriptions as well on the headstones there, you could spend, and I have, a couple of hours just going around looking at those and looking at the stories behind those family inscriptions as well. We'll do that another time. Now, a few months ago, we interviewed the well-known historian Richard Van Endem, and we talked about the boy soldiers and the book and the research that Richard has done. And it was my intention at some stage to use one or two of the stories. And I've picked one out to discuss with you now, because, again, it tells us a story from beyond the grave, really. And it concerns a young man called Ernest Steele, who came from Leytonstone in East London. He was just 17 when he volunteered. Richard says in his book that he was a quiet, reserved boy, and he was fond of reading and noted for his studiousness. He was working in the family business as a box maker. As soon as war came, he enlisted along with several of his mates. After his basic training, he arrived in France in mid-1915. And he's another one that, against all the army regulations, kept a diary for his own use. And in December 1915, he found himself at Ypres, on the side of the canal. He says, "In the evening, we went up to the firing line. We had to belly flop in mud and water 4 times in half a mile, owing to machine guns and rapid fire. We got over near Hoog when the mine went up, and then overcame umpteen shells and rapid fire. I got into a ditch, up past my knees in mud. I was helped out, and we rushed across the field over to support trenches with wire. I fell over a dead man. On the way back, we had to belly flop again, owing to rapid fire, and going through Ypres, shells burst 10 yards away. I got hit slightly. 5 men in another party wounded. Ugh," he says. By 1918, Steele had been on the Western Front for 3 years and he gained a commission. He was now 21 years old. But as time went on, his letters home became quite optimistic. September the 5th, 1918, he says, "I expect we shall be getting a little excitement shortly. Everything is going well, even better than the papers say, and I hope to be home for good in less than a year." 6 days later, on the 11th of September, he says, "We've advanced upteen kilometres, carrying all our kit and got absolutely no sleep. I hope to have a couple of days rest now before going up again. Jerry is beginning to make a greater show of resistance now, and it is harder work pushing him. Now, by this time, the British advance was reaching the last real big defence line for the Germans, what they thought was the impregnable Hindenburg line. By this time, Ernest was serving with the 21st Battalion of the Machine Gun Corps, and he was told that he would go forward with a section of machine gunners in order to support the attack by the infantry. And the night before, on the 17th of September 1918, he wrote home to his parents. And he said, "As I don't suppose I'll have the chance of writing to you again for a few days, I thought I'd take this chance of letting you know so that you shouldn't worry. We had a bit of a storm last night, but today the sun is out again and it's quite fine. There's a strong wind too to dry up the ground. I think we are winning the war, hand over fist now, and it won't last much longer. When I come home on leave, I shall be able to tell you quite a lot of facts, which of course can't be mentioned at present. While I'm out here, I realise more than ever all that you've done for me, and I wish I could have a chance to repay you at least a part. I shall never be able to do it in full. However, the time will come after I get home when I shall have that chance, and you will see, as I know you realise now, that I understand exactly what I owe to you. Well, au revoir, mother and father. God bless you and keep you safe till I come back. The best of love from your eldest affectionate son, Ernest." So the next morning, they do go in to attack, but before they do so, Ernest was doing a recce on a position for his guns near a railway track. And without realising it, he came into close contact with the enemy, who began to bomb and shoot at the machine gunners that he was commanding. And it was at that moment that this young officer, remember he was just 21, was killed, shot by a sniper. As the front line moved forward, Ernest's body was recovered and his private possessions were handed in by a section sergeant. And the next evening, at 7 o'clock, Ernest was buried in the village churchyard under the shadow of a crucifix that was still standing, but the church at that time had been destroyed. Battalion pioneers made a wooden cross. Letters of sympathy were sent to the family by various people that knew Ernest, including the sergeant that had recovered his personal belongings. The company CO, a Major J.B. Harding, wrote to his parents and said this. He said, "I can say perfectly truthfully that without exception he was the best officer I had. He was so exceptionally straight and conscientious. His men thought the world of him, and he gave his life for England, as one could have imagined he would, in a gallant way, leading and protecting his men. He was not more than 20 yards from the enemy when he was shot through the heart and killed instantly. I saw him afterwards, and although I've been out here for nearly 4 years, I've never seen so peaceful and wonderful a look on anyone's face as was on his. I'm glad to say he was buried not on the battlefield, but by our own padre in the church at Hiddecor. I feel sure he's at peace with his God." And he's not in the cemetery now, at the church. He's still in the same village, but he's buried in one of the Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemeteries in the same village, as I say. He goes on in his letter, "They called him Geordie Steele. He was one of my dearest friends. I feel he's lost so much that I can understand a little what it must mean to you. We had so much in common. We used to keep up our knowledge of German together. He and I used to be very keen on chess, and I think I knew a good deal of his private affairs. For instance, it was only 3 days before he was buried that he'd gone to see the padre about his confirmation. I knew he was engaged to be married, and I should very much like to have written to the lady concerned, only I have no address. He also talked of his younger brother, to whom he seemed so devoted that I should like to have written to them all. We therefore express my most deep sympathy to all, but more especially to your wife and yourself." Like all of these bereaved parents, there's no way that Ernest's parents could have ever recovered from what happened to their young son. A 17-year-old boy initially who should never have joined up in 1914. A young lad who put his brother off from doing the same. His brother was going to join up as well, but he persuaded him not to, having experienced the Western Front for some time. And how his family felt about his death can be seen in the family inscription on his grave. It says, "Man's inhumanity to man makes countless thousands mourn. and as we know, it's still happening to this day. His parents created a beautiful velvet-lined wooden box, and inside of it there's a book that says Inglorious Memory, imprinted in gold letters on the front. And the idea of this was that the parents wanted to commemorate their son's life with pictures of him as a baby and a boy. It's photographs of the house that he lived in, which he left to enlist in 1914. And also they kept his letters from the front, which is why we managed to quote them today and why Richard's Van Endem has included them in his book. But amongst the book pages are lines of remembrance that were written by his father over the next 25 years. In 1921, on the anniversary of his death, the 18th of September, his father wrote, "Memory keeps us close to him, but time brings us nearer." He said, "The years will by and time speeds on. We still don't realise he's gone. His memory is with us all the while, and time brings scarce relief. 9 long years that seems at times but a day." And that's dated 18th of September 1927. Now, up to now, we've only heard from these men, their voices from beyond, with me reading them, or poems read by other people. But incredibly now, we're going to hear the words from one of those men themselves, and not any old man, but a recipient of the Victoria Cross, Corporal 10523 Edward Dwyer, 1st Battalion of the East Surrey Regiment. And he was awarded the Victoria Cross for his actions at Hill 60 near Ypres on the 20th of April 1915. His citation reads, "For most conspicuous bravery and devotion to duty. When his trench was heavily attacked by German grenade throwers, he climbed onto the parapet, and although subjected to a hail of bombs at close quarters, he succeeded in dispersing the enemy by the effective use of hand grenades. Private Dwyer displayed great gallantry earlier on this day in leaving his trench under heavy shell fire to bandage his wounded comrades." So there's two different actions there that saw him awarded the Victoria Cross, and at that stage he was just 19 years old. Now, just a few days after carrying out this action, he was promoted to Lance Corporal, and a few days after that he was wounded with a gunshot wound to his head. And that wound saw him evacuated back to England, and on the 28th of June 1915 it was King George V that presented him with the Victoria Cross at Buckingham Palace. He recovered from his wounds, and he was posted to a reserve battalion, and he stayed at home for several months, carrying out training duties and recruiting. Now, he then got married to a lady called Maud on the 20th of December 1915, and it turns out that she was the Red Cross nurse who tended to him in France when he'd been wounded in the head. They didn't have any children because they weren't married for that long. Now, whilst he was at home convalescing, he actually made a recording of his experiences on the Western Front. And I can play that to you now. It's not often that we get a chance to hear the voice of a man that was killed in World War One, let alone a recipient of the Victoria Cross.
"There was only one thing to cheer us up on the march, that was singing. We used to sing Tipperary choruses, invented by some of the chaps. Tipperary was in full swing then, and they'd always gone to something they'd invented themselves. It used to buck us up, and we could march all the better for it. Sometimes we'd sing some of T.H. Eliot's songs, you know, the chocolate-coloured tune. But we'd always go into something we'd invented. I don't think I've got much of a voice for singing, but I'd try and sing one or two of the choruses we used to sing. We're here because we're here, because we're here, because we're here. We're here because we're here, because we're here, because we're here. We see far better off, in us. Here we are, here we are again. Hello, 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 hello. Hello, 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 hello.
Woo! I've heard that recording many times over the years, but every time I do, it sends a cold chill down my spine, hearing the voice of a man singing, sounding so cheerful, and yet a few months later he was dead. He returned to duty just a month after being married in January 1916, and he was promoted to corporal in July 1916. But then at Gullimont, on that dreadful day, the 3rd of September 1916, he was killed by a shell fire whilst guarding a prisoner who was also killed. And he was now buried, he now lies in Flatiron Copse Cemetery, which is just near Mehmet's Wood. Now, he left his Victoria Cross in the care of a man called Father Brown. He was the man that had married him and Maud. And Father Brown kept the VC until 1962, when he died. And this final story isn't necessarily, well, it isn't voices from beyond, but it's an object from beyond. And it's one of those stories that I picked up on a battlefield tour a few years ago. I was taking a family to Ypres, and we were following in the footsteps, not unusually, of a relative that had fought and died during one of the battles at Ypres. And on the way over, the lady that was taken produced a bracelet that had been inscribed with the names of a Lance Corporal L.A. Marley of the 8th Battalion of the East Yorkshire Regiment. And he'd been killed on the first day of the Battle of Arras, the 9th of April 1917. And this bracelet belonged to him, and it was sent back to England after he was killed, and it became the possession of his girlfriend that he hadn't had time to marry. And she was obviously heartbroken, and she went on to marry and no doubt have a contented and happy life. But she never forgot that boyfriend who died at Arras and is now buried in the Beraines Road Cemetery on the edge of the city of Arras. She never forgot him, because she kept that bracelet all of her life. And when the relative, it was her mum that had kept that bracelet, when she told me about it as we were on the Eurotunnel, I realised that we had to make a detour of our tour. It's not something you can do if you've got 30 or 40 people on a coach, but when you're doing a private tour for a family, if it's possible, you can make a detour. And this was quite a big detour. Instead of going directly to Ypres, first of all, we went to Arras and then cut across. And I took that lady to the grave of that man, Marley, and she reunited the bracelet with him, with his headstone. And we've got a wonderful photo, which I'll put on the website, my website, personal website, terrystours.co.uk, of that lady standing there with the bracelet sitting on top of the headstone of Lance Corporal Marley. So not words, but an object from beyond. An object that will remain in that family and be passed down forevermore. And it was the first time in over 100 years that Marley had been reunited with that bracelet. We often hear on this podcast and on documentaries and other podcasts the words of soldiers who gave interviews or wrote their memoirs after the war. But to me, it takes remembrance to a different level when you can hear the words of those who were shortly to pay the ultimate price for their king and country, or in the case of the Germans, for their Kaiser and country. For me, the idea of doing a podcast like this week is that I thought it would enable us to get inside the heads of these men and really understand what their thoughts were. And I think the message that's come through for me in the last hour or so is the love for their families back home and worrying what was to become of them. It's been quite emotional to record this today for so many reasons. And at times I've had to pause the recording and have a wander around my garden, have a cup of coffee and get my thoughts back together again, because it really did affect me doing this. And if you get that same feeling when listening to these stories that I've told today, then those young men from both sides of the wire will always be remembered. And maybe when you're next out on the battlefields, if you can get out to the battlefields, you'll go and see the graves of people like Charles May and Edward Dwyer. And when you do, perhaps take a transcript of the words that they wrote. The road, in case of Dwyer, the songs that he sang, the recording, you can find it on YouTube. And when you play that at those graves, it really does take your emotions onto an even greater level than we've been able to do today. It's something I really do recommend. So all it remains for me to do is to thank you again for tuning in to the podcast, Tales from the Battlefields. And we're going to do what we normally do, remember all of these men that died shortly after writing those words by the playing of The Last Post.